G'day, you mob, and welcome to this episode of Aussie English, the number one podcast for anyone and everyone wanting to learn Australian English, as well as a fair dose of our culture, history, news and current affairs, all that jazz. So guys, I'm your host, Pete. Thanks for joining me today. Today, I have the pleasure of chatting with native title historian and author Michael Bennett about his latest book, Pathfinders, A History of Aboriginal Trackers in New South Wales. Now, this was a really fascinating book as it sheds light on a very hidden part of Australian history, that of the trackers, the Indigenous men and women who were employed by the police to use their amazing tracking skills in order to track down lost people, to solve crimes, everything like that that the police, the European police, couldn't do themselves. So, without any further ado, guys, let's just get into this episode. It's a long one, but it is worth it. All right, let's go. Actually, wait, one sec. Before we get into it, I want to apologize to you because I just remembered that the audio dropped out two or three times during this episode. So I really apologize for that, guys. I'm going to try and work on that in the future. But during times of quarantine, we are limited to using things like Skype and Australia's internet sucks sometimes. So yeah, anyway, apologies for that. Let's get into the episode. G'day guys, welcome to this episode of Aussie English. Today I have native title historian Michael Bennett on the podcast. Michael, welcome.
Oh, hello Pete, and thanks for having me on the podcast. I'm looking forward to it.
No worries. So, I don't know how I came across your book. I think I was, as you can see, I've got a lot of history behind me. I went on a binge recently after COVID locked us all down trying to buy a whole bunch of books. And I think I came across yours, contacted the publishers and was like, is there any way I can get an interview with this guy? And I think within a few minutes, it was like, yes.
Oh, that's fantastic. You do have a great collection there. I can recognize some of the books you've got behind you. So
yeah, I know. Well, it's weird, isn't it? I think I'm 33 this year, and I think it's probably been since doing the podcast on Australian English and getting a bit more into Australian history that I've only sort of just got sucked into really wanting to learn more about Australian history. What was your story in terms of you know, becoming a historian?
Well, look, I mean, I've been interested in history since I was a kid. Look, I grew up in Dubbo in the central west of New South Wales. And I remember coming down to Sydney and my mum and dad take me to the Australian Museum and seeing some of the displays there. And I was only about five or six, but they really stuck in my mind. And then going back to Dubbo as well, and it's quite a historic town. And I knew a lot of Aboriginal kids and Aboriginal families out there. And I think it was by growing up in Dubbo that I started to get interested in Australian history, Aboriginal history as well. And I took it from there once I came back down to Sydney to go to university.
So, what was it like growing up in a community that had a lot of Aboriginals living there? Because it's one thing that I get asked a lot about Indigenous life in Australia, and it's something I have to sort of admit I have absolutely, or close to absolutely no idea, because I grew up in a very non-Indigenous part of Australia, right near Melbourne, where, you know, the Indigenous people here have pretty much been pushed out over the last 200 years. So, what was it like growing up in a town where obviously there were many more and the cultures were right there next to one another?
Well, look, it was quite fascinating. Like, so I had a lot of Aboriginal friends at school. I'd be, you know, playing cricket and soccer with a lot of other Aboriginal kids too. And they were just, you know, part of the scene out there. I mean, you could certainly still, there were, you know, sadly, you know, sort of other racist attitudes towards the Aboriginal kids and families. You could see that coming through as well. But on the other hand, it was great, for at least from my perspective, growing up and being exposed to Aboriginal people and culture for a long time. And it's a bit like that in Sydney where I am too. Like, unless you're sort of part, I guess, of working with Aboriginal communities, you don't meet a lot of Aboriginal people. Yeah. But it's certainly different in the country where there's a much larger Aboriginal population.
So, do you think that's something that most Australians miss out on and would probably be, I don't know, I don't want to say better people, but have a better understanding of the world and of Australian history and cultural relations if they'd had your sort of childhood in that sort of area?
Yeah, look, I think so. Absolutely. It does give you a different perspective as well. And I mean, I was just interested in history generally and hearing about some of the old Aboriginal characters that that lived in and around Dubbo back in from my grandparents' time, back in the earlier part of the 1900s. And that's how we sort of became very interested in the Aboriginal trackers who worked for the police, and that led to the book. But look, certainly getting that experience from a young age of living in sort of reasonable close proximity to other Aboriginal people helped me develop that sort of more broader understanding of their culture, I think.
So what do you think it is that most Australians don't really appreciate in terms of the differences or even the similarities between our cultures?
Yeah, look, I think that's a good question. I think a lot of it does perhaps come from the fact that they haven't experienced living in with Aboriginal people. There's a lot of similarities, like to this day. Like one of the biggest Aboriginal events in New South Wales each year is the rugby league knockout.
Yep.
May not happen this year in current circumstances, but generally it takes place every October long weekend on the NRL for the rugby league states. That's when the NRL grand final is on as well. So, and there are teams from all around New South Wales. They come from Dubbo. They'll come from Wagga. They'll come down from the north coast and the south coast, and they gather at one venue. And the venue in New South Wales changes from year to year depending on who wins to play this rugby league knockout. So there's a men's competition and a women's competition, and they just love the sport. Like in other states, of course, the Aboriginal communities really love AFL, but in New South Wales and Queensland, they love rugby league. So that's a fascinating event to go to, because rugby league is loved by many other people as well. There's those similarities. But to see that cultural event, to see all the families together, that's probably one of the biggest differences that I've sort of noticed between Aboriginal families and sort of non-Aboriginal families, is that a lot of Aboriginal families are sort of much broader.
Yeah.
They have, they've got so many aunts and uncles and cousins that they know and interact with on a regular basis. It's not your nuclear family or anything like that. Well, that's the big families.
They are really that sort of definition, at least as much as I've learnt recently about how their communities work when they're raising children. It is the village raises the child, right? More so than just the parents.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And you can see, you can see that. You see that at the knockout, most definitely, with all the big family groups getting together. But, you know, I guess through my work as well, I get to travel around and visit a lot of Aboriginal communities, and you see those features coming through in the communities and at meetings as well.
Do you think that's something that we're missing out on these days? Because I feel like in my short lifetime of 33 years, I feel like when I see movies about any time in the past where you have people living on farms, agriculturally, or even indigenous populations, whether they're from Africa, you know, South America or Australia, I sort of feel some sort of a nostalgia for when people lived in really tight-knit groups and you got to spend every day with your family, your friends, your cousins, you know, just effectively surviving but having fun and just interacting with other human beings. In the world that we're in currently, with obviously social media and coronavirus being locked at home, do you think that we sort of miss something to that aspect of life?
Yeah, look, I think personally that we do. And, you know, you can see the important role that you know, just grandparents and aunts and uncles can play in helping to raise children and look after them. And that can be a lot harder when, you know, a lot of families now are global. You'll have family members, of course, living around the world.
Well, my wife's Brazilian, so she hasn't seen her anyone in her family for 5 years now, and it's just like that's the new norm, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I think that is missing to a certain extent. I mean, you know, certainly not always in non-Aboriginal families. But I think it's something that it's probably hard to bring about, but it's something that the general community can learn from Aboriginal culture and families, definitely.
I wonder too. I'm a big fan of Steven Pinker and some of his books, his works. I think The Better Angel of Our Nature, and I think he was talking at one point about depression growing and growing and growing, sort of as we're getting better technology, we're living longer, we're healthier, you know, but we're more isolated than ever, almost like a stranger in a crowd, right?
Yeah, look, absolutely. But maybe we can feel more a bit like that at the moment when we're isolated in our homes. I mean, there's sort of a bit of a contradiction there. In some ways, it's great that we're at home with our families, but those broader connections are harder to sustain. I mean, this is only short term, but I think perhaps events like this can make people reevaluate to a certain extent, you know, their broader social relationships. So it will be interesting to see how society might change after after the COVID is diminished somewhat.
Yeah, it seems like it's going to be one of those things where you're probably going to appreciate connections with friends and family a lot more. But at the same time, I reckon that there's going to be this short or close range sort of separation as well. You know, people are going to be less likely to hug and kiss and shake hands after this. I reckon so it's going to be weird to see how do we react. Do we become this, you know, a society more like Japan or something where there's less physical contact?
Yes. Yeah. It's interesting with Aboriginal families too. I mean, there is a lot of physical contact I've observed too between all the families. Yeah, lots of hugging and that type of interaction. Yes, and perhaps particularly in those cultures, it can make it harder to even harder still to maintain your social distance when you're used to having that type of interaction.
Have you done much research on individuals in early Australian history that were European born or of European descent that ended up living with Indigenous people? Because it seems like, and it seems to be reflected in the US and other places too, it's a sort of one direction that people go, right? You don't really tend to have a lot of Aboriginals becoming Europeans and being like, yeah, this is the best ever once they get a taste of the culture. But you have a lot of white people who end up living like William Buckley with the Indigenous people for decades and almost relishing that ability, right?
Look, I haven't done so much of that research myself. I mean, I've done, particularly from my native title work, a lot of genealogical research tracing back current communities' ancestors to the earliest ancestors who were living on the land when white people came. And look, you will often see these relationships that are formed between particularly Aboriginal women and non-Aboriginal men.
Yes.
And there's a variety of those relationships. Sometimes they were coerced and quite short of duration. Other times there were longer relationships that were established over long periods of time. And in those cases, the white men were coming to live in and amongst all the Aboriginal families on reserves and missions in the mid 1800s.
Yeah.
So look, it is interesting to observe those coming together of the cultures. I've seen that, and I've written about this in the book too, that a lot of that culture was preserved by senior Aboriginal women. Even if they may have happened to marry a non-Aboriginal man, they were the knowledge holders who were then passing on all their skills and knowledge to the next generation as well. So they were building a bridge but still maintaining the culture too.
So they actually had a really strong role, did they, the women? Because it seems like in some of the limited sort of research I've done, I read this recently, which was Aboriginal Australians, a history from since 1788 by Richard Broome.
Oh, okay, Richard Broome's book, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
To sort of try and get a bit of a background. But it seemed like that you have, you know, white culture gets here, kind of swamps black culture, and they take a shadow kind of position to history. And then the women of Indigenous communities take a further sort of the shadow of a shadow position, right? So that you don't actually get to really learn about too much of what was going on behind the scenes and how much of an important pivotal role they played.
Look, it's been an overlooked area, I think, of Aboriginal history. And look, even when I was writing my book, which was mainly about male trackers, but it was the publishers who were saying, well, look, it would be interesting if you considered Aboriginal women as well. So I went back and found some stories about Aboriginal women who had those skills. Of course, they had all the traditional skills to be able to survive in the bush, but they'd been largely overlooked. So I was able to identify some Aboriginal trackers, female trackers who worked at, you know, out of Brewarrina and along the Lachlan River in Western New South Wales in the late 1800s. But at the same time, I was also finding other Aboriginal women. There's a classic case from Sydney. An Aboriginal woman is born in the early 1800s called Biddy Giles. So she lived in the southern areas of Sydney, right down into the Illawarra and the Shoalhaven. And she lived with her English husband for a long time, Billy Giles, around the shores of Botany Bay, George's River, that type of area. And they would take hunting parties. There would be interested white people would come and see Biddy, and she would take them on hunting trips, like kangaroo hunting trips out into the bush to the south of Sydney. There's this one classic case where she's taking the men out to go hunting, and one of them loses his little pocket watch, you know, the little fold up watches that were around before people had wristwatches.
Probably quite expensive too, right?
Yeah, it's absolutely very expensive. And he said to Biddy, I've lost my watch. So she said, look, don't panic. And she just retraces his steps back a few kilometers and finds the watch where he dropped it. So he was very happy about her tracking skills. But yeah, so she was taking people out fishing as well. She was like, she knew how to catch fish in Botany Bay. Never failed to you know, pull in a good haul. So here's this Aboriginal woman in the mid 1800s, living in and around Sydney and down towards Wollongong. She's found a place as best she can in society. She's got an English husband. She's part of the Aboriginal community in southern Sydney as well, but at the same time, continuing on some of those traditional practices, but in a slightly modified way to enable her to earn a living.
So the book you've written is Pathfinders. How did you decide that you wanted to write this book?
Well, it's going back to my time in Dubbo as well. I think I mentioned before hearing from my grandparents' generation about some of the characters, Aboriginal characters from Dubbo, and foremost among those was Tracker Alec Riley, who had a long history of working for the police and finding people lost in the bush and solving murders. And my grandparents knew Tracker Riley, and they'd mentioned him. So that's, I guess, when the seed was planted back in the 1980s. And, you know, jump forward 20 years and I'm starting to do some of my other Aboriginal history work, and I find all these other stories about trackers, and I'm able to go back to Dubbo and uncover a bit more of that history. So, yeah, but it was certainly back in Dubbo where that interest began.
So what is a tracker? What makes them so interesting out of all the different sorts of careers that Aboriginals would have had at the time with European yes. settlers there?
Well, look, traditionally, it was, I guess, part of the hunting skills that Aboriginal people had and just the food gathering skills. You had to be able to go out and follow the kangaroo tracks to learn where they were so you could spear them and catch them for your dinner. You also needed to know who else might happen to be in your area that shouldn't be there if there was sort of a raider coming from a neighboring group as well. So, and look, from day one, well, from very early on, Aboriginal kids were taught skills about how to follow and how to read the landscape, how to follow people across the landscape, how to, you know, not just trace the footprints, but just to identify all the little minute changes that people make as they move across a landscape. And that was the skills that the early colonial police didn't have and came to rely on trackers. So from quite early on, in the convict period in and around Sydney, from time to time, the authorities would ask Aboriginal men to track the escaped convicts, to follow the path through the bush to where these convicts were hiding. And, you know, Aboriginal men were doing that, and Aboriginal women too, from quite early on. So that was the beginning of that history, and it's a history that has continued through to Australia until the fairly recent past.
What do you think was going through their heads when the Aboriginal people were first asked to do those kinds of jobs? Because I assume those sorts of skills, that skill set that they would have had, would have been like, well, you know, me speaking English, right? It would have just been well, everyone can do this. What do you mean you need me to do it for you?
Yeah, look, you can imagine that. I think generally that you know, if just thinking about Sydney, that quite early on that they learnt that after the arrival of the First Fleet, that you know, the officers and the convicts were struggling. They did not they were human, but they did not know about how to survive in this landscape.
As long as they stay together, they're fine. But as soon as they walk into the bush, they're screwed.
Yeah, they just had no idea, and that continued right through the 1800s as well. Like, well, even once the, you know, the current New South Wales police force was formed back in 1862. And look, most of their officers that they initially employed were English and Irish and had no experience in the Australian bush.
Yeah.
So they were relying on the trackers just to be even able to, like, to set up a camp and things like that. So, but it must, I think it was quite astounding initially early on about in a sense, the ignorance of the people arriving into Australia. They don't know how to, they don't even know how to catch a fish from the harbour or something like that. Because there's the usual sense that, you know, white civilization is looking on Aboriginal civilization, looking down on it. But when the roles are reversed, sometimes it can be the other way around, that the Aboriginal people have been sitting back going, oh, God, these guys don't have a clue about what they're doing. And we'll help them out. We'll help them out.
Well, so, they that was the sort of the story for the first three years of getting to Botany Bay and then Port Jackson and Sydney Cove, right? They were really on a knife's edge trying to have enough food to survive, the colony,
yeah,
that is.
Absolutely.
And they were trying to effectively kidnap a bunch of Indigenous people for months, I think, because they needed to teach them English and be like, be the go-between, help us establish relationships so we can trade and everything and survive.
Yeah. Well, I think quite in those initial years, and I'm pretty sure I can see this book just behind you, Stephen Gapp's The Sydney Wars.
I haven't read that yet, so it's coming up.
It's really worth reading, and he lays it out quite clearly about how quite quickly the Sydney Aboriginal communities, they withdrew from around Sydney Cove.
Yeah.
And that later then led to the kidnapping. You know, Captain Phillip had ordered establish friendly relations, and he did that by, you know, kidnapping Bennelong and others as well. I mean,
it was such a weird time, right? I would die to be able to go there and see with my own eyes what happened, because it seems like we look back and there's a lot of revisionist sort of layman historians these days that want to paint everyone who's white with a tarred brush, right, and that the Aboriginals were living in Eden. But it seems so much more complex than that, right, that Philip...
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Philip seems to have wanted to keep the peace and didn't want anything done to the Indigenous people because he didn't want a war, obviously. So, there was sort of he's not necessarily not racist, but he still thinks of himself as above people. But I know that he got speared, right, because he was kidnapping... He kidnapped Pemulwuy, I think. Was it Pemulwuy or Bennelong? Bennelong.
No, it's not. It's from Bennelong. And that's a fascinating event. And was that payback for having kid? Because Bennelong was there at that time at Manly Cove when Philip was speared.
Yeah.
So, and that's still debated amongst historians. It can be seen as payback, or it can be seen as perhaps what just transpired on the day with Philip's actions of coming into Manly Cove. Look, they are very complicated times, these early sort of cross-cultural relationships.
Because I think Philip there, said just don't go after them, leave them alone. You know, I understand why I was speared, and fortunately he healed up. But then you see the other side of him when I think McIntyre gets killed by Pemulwuy years later, and he says, go and find me 10 people's heads. And I think Watkin Tench has to say, no, let's do something else. Let's not behead 10 Indigenous people.
Yeah. So, look, very, very complicated times as well. And you know, ultimately, particularly from the historical point of view, from the most part, you're just relying on sources from one side of the story too. So, this, you know, generally can be a problem with Aboriginal history. That you're only sort of hearing it from one side.
Did that drive you a little bit crazy with your book at all? Where I think the most frustrating thing that I experienced with your book was how often you had to kind of couch the language of this may have happened, or it may have been this, or it may have been that.
Yeah, look, it's, and perhaps that just reflects my cautiousness as well, because like my day job is writing history for sort of in a legal context as well, so I have to be quite careful there. But look, it's just part of the nature. Like, it's interesting with Aboriginal history, there's that sense for a long time that the records weren't kept, but if you look hard enough, that there is material there. But of course, it's only going to ever tell a partial story.
Yeah.
And sometimes you have to say that it's unsure exactly what's happened. You might know the bare bones of certain events, but those deeper interpretations can be, you know, fraught with danger. You might want to jump in and say something, but without the evidence, then that can be a little bit hard. I mean, I was fortunate in that I was able to tap into, by talking with communities, a lot of oral stories that have been passed down as well by trackers and within tracker families. So and it's always then important and interesting to compare the oral history with the written record as well. And certainly with that oral history, at least that can help get more of an Aboriginal point of view, so to speak, weaved into the story.
So how do you track down a tracker when you're writing this book?
Yeah, look, that's interesting. I came across quite a few years ago now. Some there were police records from 1862. They had a salary register, which is basically just a list of all the police who were employed and how much they were paid.
Sorry, it broke up there. Sorry, what did you say? It had a salary.
Yes, and it's like a salary register, basically listing all the different police employees and how much they were paid. And they kept separate pages for all the trackers, and so you would see Tracker Billy and Tracker Tommy. This is back in the 1860s, and that was always a bit frustrating. It was just like, why can't? And they weren't at that point listing where they were working. They were just their names and how much they were paid. But then occasionally they would include a bit more information, like a surname or some other contextual information. And then by just slowly building up the story, you're looking at newspaper records and other court documents, the oral history as well. You can start to actually identify certain who these people were. Occasionally there are even photographs particularly from the late 1800s, the main source of photographs for Aboriginal people is jail records, unfortunately. Each time someone was in a jail, they took a photograph, like a mugshot. But it's all these different records that you can come to rely on that you gradually build up a picture. The situation certainly changed a lot since I first began researching. There is phenomenal websites now like Trove, run by the National Library, where they've scanned in so many regional newspapers, and you can just search through those and come across phenomenal stories, as well as other types of records as well that are in the government archives.
So did you sort of just have to try and work out their names or places that they grew up in or worked in, and then do those sorts of searches through those kinds of materials in order to try and get the meat on the bones of this book?
Yeah, look, absolutely. And through my work in Native Title, I was traveling around the state a lot and meeting with lots of communities. And I was then able to sort of meet with the descendants of some of the trackers too. And when I later on come back and talk to them about their knowledge too. So it's a long-term process. Like, I probably started, in a way, researching the book about 15 years ago. And it was over time that I just built up all the documents and built up all the community connections too, to be able to gather enough information together to try and tell the story.
Yeah, far out. So what was the average life of a tracker like? And their day-to-day life as well, I guess.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, from some, they had many different roles. I mean, occasionally, I guess it's like a lot of jobs, you'd have the dull, boring jobs. Like, trackers, sometimes they were just weeding and mowing the police paddock, or they were tidying up around the police station. But other times, then they would be out pursuing bushrangers for months on end. Their lives was a balance of sort of excitement and boredom. But I mean, some trackers kept at the job for 50 years. Which is an extraordinary length of time. Other trackers might have only been employed for a month or two and thought, well, this is not really for me. But, they had a variety of jobs, from the exciting, for pursuing bushrangers and arresting them. Many trackers were actually very skilled horsemen. They'd grown up in the early pastoral era. So they knew how to ride horses. They knew how to break in horses. So there were trackers who sometimes their sole work was looking after the police horses and breaking them in and training them for other police officers to ride. Other times they'd be out on patrol. Police in rural parts of New South Wales in the late 1800s, they would go out on patrol for maybe a week on end, and they would go from pastoral station to a pastoral station and just maintain that contact police in the community. They might have a summons to deliver, or they might have to investigate a person who was missing. So I think that's probably what made the work quite interesting for a lot of trackers, is that that was a variety. They had a variety of things to do, and you know, sometimes when you woke up in the morning, you weren't quite sure exactly what it is you were going to be doing that day.
Well, I think in the book, it mentions quite often that they're going after children that are missing or people who've disappeared off into the bush, and there was one story about a tracker who was after a young boy who disappeared, and he was quite switched on, right, because he ended up discovering where the boy had gone, which was against what the police had assumed, yes. Right?
Yes.
Can you tell that story?
Yeah, look, I mean, it's a sad story in the end, and it involves Tracker Riley in the late 1930s, and a little boy had gone missing from a community, Boogledai, which is about an hour and a half north of Dubbo, on Christmas Day. He's like a two-year-old boy, and he and his parents were visiting their grandparents, who lived in Boogledai. And the grandparents said to the grandkids, oh, look, they prepared like a tray of cakes to take to the neighbors. And they said, oh, kids, just run that up to the neighbors. So this little boy and his older sister started to, you know, the short walk up the road to deliver the cakes. And the little boy got tired and said to his sisters, he was just going to sit there. But by the time they came back, he was gone.
Yeah.
So then the search began. And Tracker Riley, he wasn't called. He couldn't get there straight away. And there's all sorts of different interpretations of this story. He couldn't get there for a couple of days. But by the time he got there, the police and the townsfolk were tending to look a bit more towards the east. They thought that's where the boy had gone. But Tracker Riley, he looked around, and his theory was that you know, young kids, and this was just a toddler, are often attracted by big features in the landscape, and they walk towards there. And he said, look, we should be focusing the search in completely the other direction. Now, he couldn't convince the police at that stage to look where he wanted to. And like the story really played on Tracker Riley's mind. And 6 months later, he said to the inspector back in Dubbo, hey, look, can I keep looking for that boy? And the inspector said, yes. So Tracker Riley, he went back up north past Coonabarabra and he had a couple of trainee cadet trackers with him. Young Aboriginal men from around the state who were being sent to Tracker Riley to learn the skills. And so they focused their search to the west of town towards those mountains. And, you know, within a day they found the remains of that boy. So, which is it's a tragic story. And sadly, there were so many of these types of tragic stories. That trackers, you know, sometimes they're just called in too late. They had the skills, but it didn't always turn out to be a happy ending in this case.
And with the bush rangers, when they were going after those sorts of guys, like Ben Hall being tracked down by Bill Dargan, was it a really dangerous job to be doing for Aboriginal trackers?
Oh, yeah, look, absolutely. I mean, these trackers were putting their lives on the line, and there's the story of Tracker Dargan at one point. He and the sergeant have confronted Ben Hall and his gang in the bush not far from Forbes. And at one point they're pursuing Ben Hall, but then the tables are turned and suddenly Ben Hall is pursuing Tracker Dargan. The bush and Tracker Dargan, his guns ran out of ammo. Trackers were given guns to, you know, they were armed. So he's like thrown the gun at Billy Hall and continued to run away. And, you know, Ben Hall's reputed to have said to Tracker Dargan, look, we'll let you go. You're a plucky fella. And, but, you know, eventually the tables were turned. Tracker Dargan, another tracker called Charlie Edwards, they led the police to where Ben Hall was camped in the bush not far from Parks. And that's when Ben Hall was ambushed and killed. And, you know, Billy Dargan was there with he was firing. Some of the shots that he fired helped to dispatch Ben Hall. But look, it was dangerous work. And, you know, trackers put their life on the line. There's another classic example too is Watkin Wynne. Or Jackie Watkins, who came from the country sort of between John Mudgee, but he was called in a few years after the Ben Hall event to track the Clark brothers, who were a couple of notorious bush rangers who operated to the south of Braidwood in southern New South Wales. And, you know, the Clark brothers, their father was suspected of murdering an Aboriginal man. The Clark brothers themselves had killed four special constables. They were wanted men. And the premier at the time, Sir Henry Parkes, was getting a bit exasperated with the inability of the police to capture these Clark brothers. And he knew about, you know, he knew about Sir Watkin and Sir Watkin's sergeant that they'd worked together near Mudgee, and he sent them down to pursue the Clarks. And so Watkin led the police to where the Clark brothers were hiding in a hut. There was a shootout early one morning, and you know, Sir Watkin's in there, you're firing away, but he gets in the arm from one of the Clark brothers. The Clark brothers are eventually arrested and sent to Sydney to trial, but Sir Watkin's taken back to Braidwood and has to have his arm amputated at the local hospital. And that's the end of his tracking career. He retires after that, but it was dangerous work. Those trackers had to put their life on the line at times. So it's interesting to think what was going through their mind to the courage that they had to show in these circumstances.
Yeah, what do you think their motivations were? Because I would imagine that if it were me, you'd be like, this isn't my fight. Why am I getting shot at?
Yeah, absolutely. Why would they bother? At the same time, I think perhaps in some trackers, I think we're just accepting of the reality to a certain extent. They had to find work for their families. They had to, I guess, perhaps look at themselves and say, no, what skills have I got that can be useful in this society that I live in? And because it was a way for them, particularly in the broader society, to gain, I guess, some recognition for the work that they were doing, for the skills that they had. It wasn't always favorably looked upon by other members of the Aboriginal community, because there's, of course, lots of stories of trackers tracking other Aboriginal people.
I was about to ask you about that and the sort of clash between the cultures and the different systems of law, right, and who you had responsibilities to. What kind of position did trackers end up being in with having black law and white law?
Yeah. Look, at times it was a matter of divided loyalties, particularly when trackers were more or less working on their traditional country. And there's the story from a tracker up at Walgett in the northwest of the state from 1870. And he was asked to track his brother-in-law, which is quite a close cultural relationship. And he did. He led the police to his brother-in-law. And a couple of days later, some of the other Walgett Aboriginal men have attacked Jackie Bunda. I interpret that as retribution for having broken Aboriginal law.
So that's their form of payback as well, right?
Well, yeah, Jackie Bunda was being punished for, you know, he decided to, in that instance, to remain loyal to the police and not to his community. And certainly there are other cases that the trackers would actually maintain the greater loyalty to the culture, to their people, and of course you can understand that. Yeah. There was another tracker called Billy Bogan who was on the run in the late 1890s, and he'd been a tracker himself and survived some pretty dangerous times, but he'd eventually fallen on the wrong side of the law, and he'd escaped from custody by jumping from a train between Cowra and Bathurst, and then he'd gone on the run. As his name suggests, he comes from the Bogan River out towards Nyngan, west of Dubbo. And so he escaped. He travelled through the central west, got out to the Bogan River, then took a right-hand turn and headed up into Queensland. And it wasn't until a year later in 1896 that he was captured up near Charleville, which is like well outside his traditional country. And they brought him back to Bathurst, and he had to face the additional charges of having escaped from lawful custody. And he remarked that when he was in New South Wales, at least, he never feared the trackers. So there were trackers all through that area. He said he was related to them. And, you know, there was these stories of him being up a tree and then the police and the trackers passing below. I mean, I'm sure the trackers would have known that Billy Bogan was right above them.
Don't look up.
Don't look up. They, I guess, distracted the police, and Billy Bogan went on his way. And it wasn't until he was up at Charleville, which is like, you know, 300 or 400 kilometres north of the Queensland border and in a completely different country, like in Aboriginal terms.
Yes.
The trackers, the Queensland trackers, led the police up there to him, and Billy Bogan was arrested. So it was a balancing act all the time, I guess. The trackers had to weigh up. Like, they wanted to support their families. They wanted to be able to gain some recognition, but at the same time, you know, maintain their loyalty to their wider culture as well. So it was a very difficult act to follow. And, you know, I think some trackers did it very well and were able to maintain a long career with the police, maintain a pretty good relationship with their local Aboriginal community, and make an important, if undervalued, contribution.
Well, they seem to be such complex characters, because you seem to have, I mean, and I assume this is intentional, the way that you've selected these different stories, but you have some that become trackers for a matter of months, right? And then they're like, yeah, screw this, and potentially turn to crime. And then you have the complete opposite, where you have trackers who were criminals that then become trackers later on afterwards, are sort of reformed, as well as I think Alec Riley is one who just was a good guy the whole way through, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
The stories I tried to select were ones that, in a sense, highlight that complexity, that there's sort of no clear-cut stories. I mean, it's interesting that the last tracker in New South Wales retired in 1973, but more or less after 1950, there was very limited opportunities for Aboriginal men and women to be employed as trackers. The heyday certainly came in the late 1800s. So I sort of see it as a bit tragic that just at a time when, you know, the trackers were working out the system, how to balance their competing demands, get themselves a good job, but then suddenly it was taken away from them because, you know, police, you know, the technology changed. The way the police changed, and they no longer had the need for trackers as much as they did. So that opportunity was lost. So that's sad. But look, there's so many complicated stories.
Sorry to interrupt you. Can you tell us the story of Jimmy Guvner? Because he was someone who was a criminal, right, for quite a while, and then started working for the police. But he had amazing knowledge of how to avoid being tracked, right? And he also had a relationship with a British woman, right? Or a woman of British descent.
Yes. Yeah. Look, you know, a phenomenal story. Like, he grew up out along the Castlereagh River. And, you know, he knew that country in and around there, over towards the Hunter Valley as well. As a young boy, he fell foul of the law, and he ended up being taken down to Sydney and held in an institution in Sydney. And, you know, look, you can read the reports there, which sort of denigrate him and say, look, he's got no future at all. But nevertheless, he managed to get through that. He'd had some schooling in and around sort of Golgong, that Castlereagh River area as well. And he was starting to find a place for himself. So he'd worked as a tracker at Cassilis, which is like north of Mudgee, and he'd done some good work there. Retired, and that's when he met Ethel Page, who was, as you said, like British descent. She'd grown up around the Maclay River, around Kempsey, before her family had moved over to Golgong.
And that's a pretty unique situation too, right? It was very rare, I think you noted in the book.
Yeah, look, it's pretty rare. There's not that many instances at that stage. I mean, there are a few, but not many, of Aboriginal men marrying white girls. And this, I think, it certainly caused a lot of problems for Jimmy and Ethel. They had to endure a lot of racist insults. But, you know, Jimmy kept going. He and Ethel, Jimmy was, you know, he had a wide range of bush skills, so he was quite a good, with an axe. Was a timber cutter. So he was building fence posts with his brother on a property near Gilgandra called Breelong. And they'd been camping there and working for a couple of months, and there were disputes with the owner. Jimmy didn't think they were being paid enough. There were some taunts that were going on and insults from the family at Breelong. And Jimmy just snaps and murders members of the Morby family there, and then goes on the run with his brother, and you know they're bent on revenge. They kill and murder other people who they had grudges against. it's an extraordinary, sort of tragic story, but phenomenal in many ways too, that the fact that they were able to go on the run for like 3 or 4 months, they cover thousands of kilometres, Jimmy and his brother Joe. They go up over the Liverpool Ranges, they head up towards the Pilliga Forest. They've got police, bounty hunters, 20 trackers, 6 trackers from Queensland were brought down. They're all in pursuit of them, but they, you know, for months they never really get close. They think they're about to catch them, but Jimmy, he had all these bush skills. They knew so many tricks to try and put the police off. Like at one point they go up this mountain. Well, they start going up a mountain and then they come back down again and hide themselves and they wait for the police to come. And they police go right up to the top of the mountain and waste time, which gives them, you know, Jimmy and Joe plenty of time to get away. They rely on a sort of an Aboriginal network of families too to support them, not in the big sort of big Aboriginal stations or reserves, but just some of the small isolated settlements.
I think you said they had to avoid the settlements, right, and the Aboriginal stations because they'd be recognised.
Yeah, that's right. And the police would have been watching them. But not all Aboriginal families were living in those settlements. Some of them were just living in little places in and out of the way. But sort of Jimmy knew where they were and they would pop in and get a few supplies and take a bit of a breather before they sort of get back out on the road, so to speak. So this goes on for 3 or 4 months. They cover thousands of kilometres, but they're, you know, gradually they are worn down.
Yeah.
They go over towards the coast, which a country they didn't know so well. So they go up as far as the country to the west of Port Macquarie before turning south and eventually Joe is shot and killed out towards Singleton and Jimmy's captured, I think, to the west of Taree. So, of course, it's been a very well-known story for such a long time. You think going back to the book, The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith, which was based on Jimmy Governor's story, and then that was made into a film in the 1970s, and there have been other books as well. But why I wanted to sort of revisit that story was partly just to show the complexity from the tracker's point of view, that there were so many different trackers who weren't being brought in from the local community to pursue the governors, as well as the Queensland trackers as well. I wanted to help with that part of the story as well.
Well, that seemed to be amazing, though, those stories of just how they avoided, captured. I think you were saying in the book that they were climbing through the canopies of trees to not leave steps on the ground and walking on barbed wire fences to avoid putting
marks on the ground. Yeah, look, it's certainly they made the tracker's job very hard. And how a good tracker had to sort of think outside the box a lot. It's not just a matter of following those prints on the ground, because quite often those prints on the ground aren't there. You have good understanding of the people, I guess, you're pursuing, and human psychology in different situations as well. And what was made even harder for a lot of the trackers, particularly in relation to Jimmy and Joe Governor, is that they had bounties on the head, so there were bounty hunters who were pursuing the brothers as well, and they were often quite a bit more mobile than the police. So by the time the trackers were getting to the scene where the brothers had last been observed, the tracks were muddied and messed up a bit by the fact that the bounty hunters were already there. So that made their job even harder.
It's almost like CSI, right, a lot of the time with these guys. I mean, they're not necessarily solving crimes, but they're having to piece together scene after scene after scene to try and work out where people have gone. I think you were telling one story too. I don't know if it was Jimmy and Joe, but having to in order to speed up the way that they could track, one would cut 150 metres in front of the other to try and find the track, and then they could start again, and they could almost do it at a running pace or something, right? Something insane.
Yeah, that's right. Some of the Queensland trackers were using that technique.
Incredible.
And other trackers have used something similar as well. Like, you know, they would be spreading out in a line too, and some going ahead a bit further. So they had to be very quick on their feet, literally. Although it's interesting, some trackers, their eyes were so swift. Jimmy and Joe had a younger brother called Roy Governor, who fell foul of the law in the 1920s, like 20 years after his brothers had been on the run. And Tracker Riley was actually one of the trackers who pursued Roy Governor. Roy Governor was eventually captured and served a time in jail, but he ended up moving out towards Condobolin, and he had these skills as well. And the police were investigating a stolen horse one day, and they saw Roy, and they said, "Roy, can you help us out?"
Sorry, it broke up there for a sec. What did you say, Roy?
They said to Roy, "Look, can you help us out looking for this stolen horse?" And Roy said, "Yeah, that's fine." So Roy sort of stood on the sideboard of the police car, and he was able to track as the police were driving. So I don't know how fast they were driving, but you know, it probably at a reasonable speed. So his eye was quick enough to be able to follow these tracks, and eventually, he was able to even read the depth of the horse prints to say he knew that there wasn't just one person on that horse, that there were actually two people riding that horse. And eventually, the tracks ended at the railway line, and they got the horse. But then what they realized was that the thieves had then boarded a passing train that was heading towards Parks. So they were able to ring ahead to the Parks police, and they picked up the thieves off the train. But the speed of their eye to being able to read those tracks from a moving car is pretty impressive. And you know, even Roy is a bit like his brothers. He obviously had the skills, and maybe if things had worked out differently, he would have had a much different life.
Well, and they had to have a lot of forethought too, right? With Wyman Warrigal McLean, I think I was reading in the book that he would cover up the tracks of certain people for a later date, yes. Right?
Yeah, that's right. Like, you've got to think, okay, I can't, you know, they would sometimes take plaster casts and things like that. And because they didn't have that mobile photographic technology that we all have today. So you have to protect those tracks. So when you come back, then you'd be able to get a proper impression. And, because trackers, you know, they were, it is a bit like CSI, and they were expert witnesses. And one of their jobs too was they would be called into court to give evidence, to explain their expertise and how, you know, they managed to follow these tracks that went from one farm to another. And that led them to the conclusion that there must have been, looking at the particular boot prints of this individual, that was the individual who was responsible for stealing the cattle, or this was the individual who was responsible for burning down that haystack. And they then would have to be able to give evidence and then also be cross-examined in court too, which is by no means an easy thing. So they had to have that confidence within themselves, being able to explain their work and have it open to scrutiny as well.
How long was it before they were able to go to court and be summoned as witnesses?
Look, probably from about the mid-1870s, there was a change in the law. I can't quite remember the exact date. It's like 1875 or 1876. But before that, because the legal system recognized Aboriginal people that they weren't Christians, that they would not then be able to understand the nature of telling and an oath. I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, of course.
But you can also imagine Aboriginal people being like, "What? You want me to put a hand on this book, and that means I'll tell the truth? Like, what? What are you guys smoking?"
Well, that's true too. But so eventually, the law was changed, and there'd been a movement leading up to this, that Aboriginal people could give evidence in court, and that included trackers. And they just have to, you know, they wouldn't necessarily have to swear on the Bible. They would just need to say, "Yes, look, I understand the difference between truth and falsehood, and I'm more than happy to, you know, give a truthful of account of what I'm about to say." So, yes, yeah, but so after 1876, you start to see examples of trackers appearing in court, and you know, it would have been a testing experience for them. Tracker Riley, in particular, he was very highly regarded as a witness, I think, because of his calm demeanor. You can imagine that it would have been very difficult for the barristers on the other side to trip him up, and of course he knew his work so well too. He would have had that confidence to be able to give an accurate account of the case that he was working on.
And I think there was a story about Billy Bogan going to court to testify against someone, and that it showed that even after you had done the work, the danger didn't necessarily end, right? You could be in danger for going to court as a witness.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, Billy was due to testify against this fella, Charles Robinson, who had helped arrest Charles Robinson. He had a bit of a shady past, but he decided that he was going to steal fodder for his horses from the police station, which is, I don't know.
Asking for it.
Yeah. So Billy's helped arrest him, and Charlie's out on bail, waiting to go to court, and Billy was going to be the star witness against him. And Charlie said, he's gone up to Billy the day before, a few days before, and said, look, you know, let's be mates. We won't worry about what you're about to do to me in court and give that evidence. He said, let's go and have a drink. So Billy's, you know, naturally a bit suspicious about this. And he said, yeah, okay, well, we'll have a drink, but not right now. And he goes off and speaks to his sergeant. And so they hatch a bit of a plan, and Billy goes back to Charlie and said, yeah, look, well, we'll meet up, you know, at a certain spot. This has happened at Warren in Western New South Wales on the Macquarie River. So they meet up not far from the police station, sort of in the bush there. And the sergeant is sort of hiding behind, you know, he's hiding in the bush to observe this meeting. And Charlie Robinson turns up and said, yeah, okay, Billy, let's be friends. And he hands Billy a drink, you know, drink of grog, and then Billy takes a look at it, and it doesn't look right. So he gives it to his sergeant, and they send it down to Sydney instead. Yeah, it's full of strychnine. So Charlie Robinson, he was going to poison Billy, so Billy couldn't give evidence against him. But you know, the police, you know, they protected Billy, they valued his work, and prosecuted Robinson not only for, you know, stealing the fodder, but for attempting to murder the tracker. Billy, after that, has said, look, tracking's not for me if this is what I'm going to have to do, yeah, which is fair enough. And he leaves the force and goes and does other rural work. And, you know, eventually he falls on bad times and, as I told that story before, ends up being pursued up through Western New South Wales. But that was a sort of a key moment in his life. Like, if that hadn't happened, I'd always figure that. And because Billy had endured some pretty difficult times growing up as well, working in the pastoral industry. I mean, particularly if that attempted poisoning hadn't happened, I reckon Billy would have had a long career with the police, and his life might have turned out a bit differently. And because he ended up in Parramatta jail, and I think he got typhoid down there and died in 1900. So it's very, very sad story. You can see if things may have gone slightly differently for some of the early trackers, that their lives could have been much more successful. But it just shows how difficult it was for Aboriginal people generally to navigate that colonial world, to find their place in it.
But sometimes they did, right? I think Frank Williams was one who received a lot of awards during his career and even got a police funeral.
Yes. Yeah. Look, so he's a classic example of a fellow who was able to maintain a long career. Like, he worked for almost 50 years.
Insane.
From the early 1900s. He came from what's called Nyumba country, which is out towards Brewarrina, over towards Bourke and Byrock. And so he'd worked in all those stations. He worked for a few years at Dubbo as well. And he'd contributed. He'd done all the classic tracking cases. He'd helped find people lost in the bush. He'd helped solve bank robberies. He'd done a lot of good work, and was given he had recognition from when he was working, and then when he passed away, yes, the police were present for the funeral. And even going back a few years, not the present police commissioner, but the previous commissioner, Andrew Scipione, he was out at Bourke meeting with the Aboriginal community. And at the end of that meeting, he went out to the Bourke Cemetery and he was laying wreaths on the graves of all the policemen who were buried at Bourke. And there were three of them, and one of them was Frank Williams. So he went up and presented, he laid a wreath on Frank Williams' grave. And I know that meant a lot to the family. I was fortunate enough to be there for that day, and the family were very honoured to have that that level of recognition. So so Frank, you know, he'd made an important contribution. And certainly he had his own sort of personal tragedies. One of his sons was killed in the fall of Singapore during World War II.
Oh wow!
In fact, two of his sons had signed up for World War II. And only one came back, And sadly, the one that did come back, he came back to find out that his son had drowned while he was away fighting in World War II. So, I mean, I guess this happens in so many lives that there were, Frank had to still endure these personal tragedies of his son and grandson, but he nevertheless managed to forge a very long and successful career in the police. And that's something. Know that his descendants are proud of his work right through to this day.
When you were saying his descendants became things like policemen, nurses, scientists, so yes. he obviously paved the way for his family to obviously live successful lives after he was well and truly gone. Do you think he had an appreciation for his role between the two worlds of black and white at the time?
Look, I think he did, and I think other trackers did as well. And that's, we were talking earlier about motivation, and that was sort of part of the motivation to try and help set up his children and grandchildren for a place in society. They wanted to, I guess they wanted the best of both worlds. They wanted to be able to, maintain the traditional knowledge and skills and connection to culture, but still find a place in the modern wider world too. And I think trackers like Frank Williams and Alec Riley too exemplify that. Tracker Riley too has some of his descendants are incredible artists. And I was just speaking to another member of the Riley family recently, who's a phenomenal choreographer and is planning to down in Melbourne to put on a show that's celebrating Tracker Riley's life, but through dance. So. Oh, wow. I'm looking forward to that. It's a different way of telling the story. So, I think trackers had that in mind, that they were looking to the future as well, to find some level of security for their family.
So, finishing up, could you talk a little bit about the difference between trackers and native police, and see if you can tie that in with cultural differences, the boundaries between countries and the different languages that are spoken by the Indigenous people in Australia?
Yeah. Absolutely. So, it's certainly one of the tragic, very tragic stories of Australia is the operation of the native police. And my book's generally about a later period, but the native police operated in Victoria in the 1830s and 1840s, and then Northern New South Wales and Queensland from about 1850 right through to 1900. And the idea of this police force was to subdue and sometimes kill and disperse other Aboriginal groups. So, for example, the first native police that were established in northern New South Wales and what later became Queensland in the late 1840s, the initial members of that police force, and they were all Aboriginal men with a white sergeant, The Aboriginal native police weren't from that country in northern New South Wales, up north of Walgett. They'd been picked up they'd been rounded up much further to the south along the Murray River and Deniliquin. Up around Walgett, like the main, say the main language group out there, sort of Gimilaroi, that's and Yulurai. So there's, and but down on the Murray River, you've got Yorta Yorta people, you've got lots of other groups as well. So they're separated by hundreds of different kilometres, very different languages. And different cultures too. So I think this is one of the things that was being exploited in the native police era by using Aboriginal trackers from hundreds of kilometres away who didn't have any particularly close cultural ties to the area where they were working in. They would have felt perhaps less likely to shy away from the work that they were being required to do. I mean, that wasn't always the case. It was a very difficult life that the members of the native police were forced to leave, and many just simply got away as fast as they could. But others certainly had longer careers. So, I guess yes, that's important to note with the native police, that they were often drawn from a long way away, so they didn't have any cultural affinity to the people that they were being asked to attack. Well, that's something that the authorities realised.
Yeah, well, it must have been such a difficult you know, existence back in Australia prior to colonization, where you have such a huge landmass with so many different groups that speak so many different languages that you kind of have to have a hostile kind of attitude to anyone who doesn't speak your language, because there's no way of communicating effectively, right? And so, I think there were a few stories about when Sydney Cove was first colonized that they would try, I think Philip takes a bunch of Aboriginals to try and guide him across the Blue Mountains or something. And there, you know, he realizes pretty quickly that they don't know the country and that all the people, they're like, yeah, these are bad people here. These people are bad. But then when they meet them, they're like, ah, it's fine. You know, we'll hang out. We'll have, you know, fire together and eat everything. But is that something that the average Australian doesn't appreciate too, that we kind of look at Indigenous people and think, Aboriginals, they're all one homogenous group, but in reality, it has probably, you know, two or three times the complexity of Europe in terms of languages and cultures, right, in Australia?
Yeah, absolutely. We're talking about hundreds of different language groups across Australia, a lot of cultural and ceremonial differences too. I mean, you can, of course, you can draw similarities, but, you know, they were living in a variety of landscapes from the coast to the arid interior. So, yes, it's important to note that it's certainly Australia was not occupied by one homogenous group of Aboriginal people. So many different cultures, so many different languages. And I think, you know, that's gradually becoming better known as time goes on. And certainly the Aboriginal communities themselves know this very well.
Yeah.
But it's good to know that it's being communicated a bit more widely now.
No worries, Michael. Well, I've kept you for long enough. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Where can people find out more about you and your lovely book, Pathfinders?
Well, look, you can certainly check out my Pathfinders New South Wales website. And there are links to buy the book there. But look, you can just jump online to, you know, Booktopia, Amazon, a lot of local bookshops too, Glee Books. Abby's in the city of Sydney too, so it's reasonably widely available. So I certainly recommend, if you want to learn a bit more about Aboriginal history in New South Wales, you can take the time to read it.
Definitely. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Michael. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Pete, for the opportunity.